Okay, good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Brendan Smith, so I would have invited most of you this evening. And we have Professor Nick Rose, who is from LSE BIOS, which I hope all of you knew in advance of your time when you were at LSE. It studies, it looks at biomedicine, biotechnology, and society. And bioscience and society. And Nick has been engaged with China now for the last 4 or 5 years on a pretty substantial project funded by the European Union for about €1 million, which was a comparative analysis between Europe and China on governance and ethics on the biosciences. And we worked on that project with the lead partner in China was LSE's strategic partner in China, which is Peking University. And then we also worked with several other universities, Peking Union Medical College, Central South University, IVF Center that's on in fertilization, and various other research agencies in China. And that just completed last year. It ran for 3 years, and Nick has been back in China this time to present some of the findings to the Ministry of Health in China, which was also one of the great supporters, I think, of the project and participants in the project. And they were keen to look at some of the recommendations from the report, particularly on establishing a body. Permanent body that would look at governance issues around life sciences in Europe and China and the ethical issues. So he was with the Ministry of Health for all day yesterday working on that project. He was also at a conference on medical professionalism at Peking University, which was run also with Columbia University, which is LSE's strategic US partner, and which we also work with in China on various projects. And this evening, he's going to entertain us on health and illness in the age of genomics. Nick has the rare skill of being a sociologist and a biologist. So you're going to have a lot of terminology thrown at you, like scientists, because I've been learning a lot today just sitting in the meetings. So I do hope you find it interesting, and please give him a very warm welcome.
Well, thanks very much, Brendan. Brendan is pretty much single-handedly responsible for the 15 or so trips I've made to China over the last 7 years, which has been fantastic, and also introducing me to a range of the key players who tend to be a little bit outside the normal run of the people that the LSE would be working with. So amongst the people that we've been working with, actually there are some issues that have been quite prominent in the newspapers recently. You probably don't read Nature regularly, Nature magazine, so you won't be aware of the groundbreaking study that was presented in Nature just a couple of years ago, first study out of what's called the Thousand Genomes Project. This is a project to do a complete sequencing of the genomes of 1,000 people, selected groups of people from different population groups, including in China. And one of the partners in the BioNet project that Brendan mentioned, Yang Huangming, is the director of the Beijing Genomics Institute, now in Shenzhen, possibly the most powerful, one of the three most powerful gene sequencing institutions in the world. He was one of the partners in that project, and I'll mention Huangming's work a little bit later on, because I'm going to use one of his slides at the end. The second thing that I saw in the China news, actually, was delivered to my hotel on Sunday, which is another thing that we're kind of interested in, was a report about research which is being done on Parkinson's disease and neurodegenerative diseases. Very serious diseases which are more common in old age and which are linked in some ways that we don't quite understand to the degenerative diseases of old age, like dementias, Alzheimer's disease and so on, which are, for those who are interested in health forecasting, are probably going to become one of the major public health problems in China over the next 15 or 20 years, as China has an aging population, and as the effects of the one-child policy mean that there aren't big families to look after elderly people anymore, and many of the children have already moved from the countries into the cities. So this report was actually about research which is being done not in humans, and not even in small animals, but in monkeys, creating monkey models of these diseases in order to test out human therapies. Very controversial work in Europe, doing work with higher primates, non-human primates. So that work is being done in China. So one of our interests, and this links to another of our interests, as I say, is what happens when European researchers collaborate with Chinese researchers, maybe doing work that's a little bit controversial in Europe, but maybe feeling it's slightly less controversial in China. And the third thing which I saw, which relates to where I was yesterday with the Ministry of Health, was a report on the front page of the China News that was pushed through my hotel door on illegal IVF clinics in China. IVF, in vitro fertilization, a treatment for families who are infertile. There's actually, you may not know this, but a very high level of infertility amongst Chinese couples. And the pressure to have a child in China is very high. And so the use of these fertility clinics is growing. And the fertility clinics, of course, charge for the fertility treatments. They charge quite a lot for each round of fertility treatments. And there's been a growth in illegal fertility treatments, offering unlicensed treatments to women. We work very closely in this BioNet project that Brendan mentioned with one of China's leading and very legitimate, highly reputable IVF clinics in Changsha. Actually the clinic that created China's first test tube baby. And they are obviously very, very concerned about the way in which this kind of treatment that's both very important for families and very expensive should be regulated. So these are the kinds of things that we've been looking at. And again, they may seem not quite what LSE does, but LSE, to the extent that we're interested in regulation, to the extent that we're interested in ethics, to the extent that we're interested in the way in which these biological developments are actually changing what human beings are, what they think they are, what they think they can and should do to themselves. These are things of interest to us. And I'm just going to talk a little bit today about some of those things, not specifically about this research, not specifically about China, although a little bit about China. Now this, I'm going to talk about this, the belief that there is amongst some that we're entering a radical new age when it comes to matters of health and illness. This elegant gentleman here with the flowing white locks is not actually me. When I got this picture, I thought, well, it would be nice to be a little bit more like him, but he's Michio Kaiku. He's Japanese. And he did a series of programs on the television a couple of years ago called Visions of the Future. And amongst his vision of the future was a vision of the future that was in part fueled by biotechnology, the biotechnology revolution. And this vision is actually a very common vision that we're reaching a new area, a new part of human existence in which suddenly all kinds of things about the way in which we live as human beings, about our bodies, about our biology, have become open to science and open to technology. We can understand our body as if it's a kind of machine which we can engineer, we can reverse engineer, and we can re-engineer it. And in that way, as he says here, we're going to get a future of unprecedented health and longevity. DNA screening your genome in order to understand whether you're susceptible to a certain disease and then to target it. Gene therapy to target those diseases. Replacement of body parts with lab-grown organs. The human body, he says, can be repaired as easily as a car. Now, some of you at the LSE would have heard of the Cartesian notion that actually the body is a kind of machine. Well, then, in this sense, we've got kind of Cartesian bodies, and we can even, in this view, halt the aging process. But he goes on to say, what impact would all this have on who we are and how we live? And with our mastery of the genome, will the human race end up divided by genetic apartheid? So you get these kinds of intriguing visions of both a wonderful future in which we can take our health and our life into our own hands and recraft our body at will. The revolution is in the air. I don't know, is that an LSE alum there in that picture? I wouldn't know about that. Routine in a few years, sequencing, every baby will have its DNA read at birth. Now, I suppose there are some questions one could ask about, which I'll maybe check out, about whether this is desirable, if we could do this. If we could do this, it would radically transform the kinds of people that we are and the kinds of lives that we lead. Or is this, and to what extent is this hype? Now, I know you don't know about the science and you don't know about the biology, but who here has heard of Dolly the sheep? Okay, I don't have to put up my hand. Everybody's heard of Dolly the sheep, the first mammal that was cloned. Okay, the first cloned mammal. Well, the man who cloned Dolly the sheep, Ian Wilmot, wrote this book called The Second Creation, Dolly and the Age of Biological Control. Actually, he didn't write it, it was ghostwritten for him, but that's entirely by the by. And it was rather modestly titled, don't you think, The Second Creation. Well, whichever gods you do or don't believe in, we have a view about the first creation. His view was that this was the second creation. This was the first time in which human beings had created, by an act of biological engineering, a living creature. And this is what he says. Until the birth of Dolly, he says, scientists were apt to declare that this or that procedure was biologically impossible. But now that expression seems to have lost all meaning. In the 21st century and beyond, human ambition will be bound only by the laws of physics, the rules of logic, and our descendants' own sense of right or wrong. Truly, Dolly has taken us into the era of biological control. This argument, which I think he puts forward with complete belief in it, is the argument that absolutely nothing is biologically impossible. You want to live forever? Well, pretty soon you'll be able to live forever. You want to have children at the age of 60? Well, pretty soon you'll be able to have children at the age of 60. You want to have children without a reproductive partner? Pretty soon you'll be able to have children without a reproductive partner. You want to be able to stamp out all those horrible diseases? Well, pretty soon you'll be able to stamp out those horrible diseases. You want to be able to clone human beings? Pretty soon you'll be able to clone human beings. The only limit that we can place on the kinds of things that we're able to do to ourselves as human beings are limits that we set on ourselves. We can no longer say it's biologically impossible for a woman to have a baby without a man. It's not biologically impossible. So if we think that's a good or a bad idea, that's kind of up to us. We can no longer say it's biologically impossible for someone to live until 150. In this vision, it's up to us. Do we want everybody to live till 150, keep being professors at the London School of Economics, prevent any jobs opening up for younger people graduating? I think that's an absolutely fantastic idea, but some of you may have a different view. So his view is that biology is completely contingent. It's by the by. We can understand it. We can engineer ourselves. Now, of course, this is scientific hubris. It's very, very difficult to do many of these things. Nature often says no as much as it says yes. And many things are biologically impossible. Too many things are biologically impossible. I work with some people at the Institute of Psychiatry that are interested in the damage that stroke does. Strokes due to the human brain, causing lesions in the human brain. They would love nothing to be biologically impossible. They would love to be able to use their therapies to repair these brain lesions from brain damage or stroke, but unfortunately it remains at the moment biologically impossible to do it. You just can't do it. But nonetheless, there's this dream that you've turned the human body into a kind of machine. It's like a motor car. well, probably yours are like, I don't know, Lexus or Audis or these big things I see. Mine is like a Trabant, if you know those cars from Eastern Europe. You know, it's rather on its last legs and you have to sort of push it and it gives out a lot of fuming exhaust. But nonetheless, the idea that the body is a machine and you can engineer it, you can reverse engineer it, you can do what you like to it, you can take it apart at the molecular level. Now medicine understands the body at this molecular level, and at this molecular level, all those things that we thought were mysterious vital processes actually turn out to be just simple engineering things. You can draw circuit diagrams of them like that, you can do things about them like that, you can understand what goes on in a nerve connection like that, in a synapse like that. We can control our biology, and then we can predict our future. Now, these thoughts may be rather abstract, but in fact, these thoughts are at the heart of an absolutely booming biotechnology industry, and one in which countries like China have a huge investment. China invests a very, very large amount of money in advanced biological and biomedical research. It seeks to make itself a key player, as do many of the other Asian countries, in this biological future. If you go to Singapore and you see the Biopolis in Singapore, you'll see how this dream that biology and biomedicine can become a major economic driving force, and not just a medical driving force, is actually at the heart of many Asian economies. And this is a global biotechnology industry. So one of the key areas here is in the development of drugs. In 2007, China became the major place where Western pharmaceutical companies came to trial their drugs. You know, if you're going to make a drug trial, you're going to bring a drug to market, you've got to trial it. You've got to first trial it on animals, then trial it in small numbers of subjects, then trial it in big subjects. Very expensive to do these trials. Costs a lot. For each subject you enroll in the trial, those of you who did any math when you were at the LSE would know that in order to get statistically valid results, you've got to power up these trials, you've got to incorporate large, large numbers of people into these trials. It's very expensive to do that in the United States. It's very expensive to do it in Europe. So people are coming first to South America, then to India, and now to China in order to trial those drugs. They bring money to China, they pay money to the hospitals, they pay money to the doctors, they pay money to the patients in order to reduce the costs of drug development. If you can bring a drug to market 3 days earlier than you would otherwise have done, you have saved yourself millions and millions of dollars. So that's why these people come to China to trial their drugs. That's one of the things that this BioNet project that we were looking at looked at. So I'm just trying to show that these are not entirely abstract questions. Another question is the question of genetic research and biobanking. What is biobanking? Well, biobanking is a technique where people gather together a lot of samples from individuals, biological samples. They sequence the genetics of those samples, so they have genetic information of those samples. They also collect other information from you, like the diseases that you've had, like your family history, like your longevity, like your lifestyle and your environment, and they try and correlate all these together to understand something about the interaction between genomics and environment in the development of diseases. Again, China has become one of the key places to develop these biobanks, almost always in collaboration with Western bioscientists. The Kadoorie Biobank study in China was a very, very big one. You may ask whether or not and how these very large samples are collected from the Chinese population in order to do this biomedical research, and that may be one of the things that one might want to talk about afterwards. Again, the dream here is that by correlating genetic information with lifestyle information and with health information, you'll understand something about the genetic basis of disease. I mentioned my friend Yang Kuangming, who runs the Beijing Genomics Institute a moment ago. As I say, this has become one of the most powerful gene sequencing institutes in the world. Now, just let me stop for 1 second. Does the word genomics mean anything to people, or should I spend 2 minutes talking about what genomics is? Okay, you know, human beings are made up of many cells. each cell contains genetic material. The genetic material determines the shape of the body, and so on and so forth. The belief that the genetics is at the root of who we are as human beings, or what differentiates us from other primates, from animals, from mice, from plants, has been a very, very powerful one. And over the last 20 or 25 years, there have been major attempts to sequence the genomes of different organisms to understand their genetic basis. China, and especially the work of the BGI, has been at the forefront of doing those sequencings. First of all, about 20 years ago, there was a Human Genome Project, very, very big project to sequence the whole of the human genome. Since that project, the results of that project were published, many, many genomes of many, many creatures and many vegetables and plants have been sequenced. China did the rice genome, China did the Beijing genome, China did the first genome of an Asian individual, and as I said right at the very beginning, China is involved very much in this 1,000 genome project to actually try and understand the basis, the genomic basis of variations amongst human individuals. This is the first diploid sequence of an Asian individual. The belief is, and there's some evidence for this, that people's genetic sequence differs between population groups. This was a rather classic study that was done, as you can see, by this massive group of people, mainly from the Beijing Genomics Institute, a very powerful paper that was published in Nature. What's this got to do with the questions of health and illness with which I started? Well, some people say that this understanding, this genetic understanding of human beings, this ability to understand the genetic sequence of human individuals, and to correlate this, to link this with the kinds of diseases that people get, with maybe their life expectancy, their age of death, the number of children that they have, and all sorts of other capacities, maybe their intellectual capacities, maybe their physical capacities, that this is at the heart of a new revolution in medicine. The acronym for this revolution in medicine is personalized, predictive, and preventive. Personalized medicine, predictive medicine, and preventive medicine. Personalized. You will use your own DNA sequence, your own individual DNA sequence, to understand which exact diseases you are likely to be susceptible to. Have you got a raised or a lower level of risk for coronary heart disease? Have you got a raised or a lower risk for breast cancer? Have you got a raised or a lower risk for prostate cancer? What diseases are you subject to? Or maybe what diseases are your babies subject to? Or what diseases are your prospective babies going to be subject to on the basis of a sequencing of their genome? So, the belief. First of all, you personalize, you identify exactly what a person's disease susceptibility profile is, and then you predict on the basis of that, you predict their likelihood of getting a disease, and then you prevent. Because, of course, preventive medicine, in everybody's eyes, is better than curative medicine. Who could disagree with the fact if you knew what someone was going to get in the future, you knew what your baby was going to get in the future, of course you'd seek to prevent that disease. Personalized, predictive, or preventive. And this was the dream that many people, this is Leroy Hood, who runs a big biotech company in California, of course, this was his dream in 1992. Perhaps in 20 years' time, he says, he was writing in 1992, it will be possible to take DNA, that's the genetic sequence, from newborns, analyze 50 or more genes in it for the allelic forms, that's the variations, that can predispose the infant to many common diseases. For each defective disease, there will be therapeutic regimens that will circumvent the limitations of the defective gene. Medicine will move from a reactive mode to a preventive mode. Preventive medicine should enable most individuals to live a normal, healthy, and intellectually able life without disease. Well, and who could argue with that? Jolly good thing, we would all think. And this actually, I got this from a presentation from Yang Huaming. This is the dream behind the genome sequencing. If you can only find the genomes, you'll find the key to what makes human beings different from one another in all sorts of ways, and in particular, what makes each human being susceptible to each particular kind of disease. The time to prepare says, this is an article in the Science, I believe, the time to prepare is now. Well, I don't know how many of you have visited the website of 23andMe recently. Human beings have 23 chromosomes, 23 strings of genes in each cell. So that's why it's called 23andMe. Or DecodeMe, decodeme.com, or Graceful Earth, or Navigenics. And these are the offers that you will find on their sites. For a mere $429, you sign up on the website. They send you a little testing kit. You spit into a tube. You send the tube to California, and they send you a password. And in about 2 weeks, you log on to your protected site in the 23andMe or Genetic Health or Navigenics or whatever it is, and it will tell you your risk profile for. Well, in this case, 23andMe, breast cancer, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs. Tay-Sachs is a fatal disease for young kids. Learn your genetic risk for type 2 diabetes, for Parkinson's disease, and other conditions. Decode me $2,000 to calculate your risk for 51 conditions, and so on and so on. Graceful Earth for Alzheimer's. Check your future susceptibility for Alzheimer's disease before symptoms can occur. Preemptive insight into one's genetic predisposition can empower you and allow for proactive prevention. Well, maybe you can just think for a moment as I'm going on about whether knowing now that you are liable to get Alzheimer's disease maybe you're all very young, maybe in 30 or 40 years' time, that you had a high risk of developing a neurodegenerative disorder for which there is no available therapy, would quite empower you and allow for proactive prevention. But it's only $280, so why not? And these are the websites of some of the companies. Know Me was one of the first ones. Some of these ones only look at certain gene sequences. Know Me would give you your whole gene sequence. Decode Me would give you, join the decode journey. You can get also scanned in all sorts of ways. You can understand what Richard Powers, actually I think he's a fantastic novelist. If you've never read any Richard Powers, I would definitely read Richard Powers. He's really terrifically good. But he had his whole genome scanned, and he published this article, The Book of Me. Read the book of life, read the book of my life. And this is what they say on the website about the customers who've done this. Our customers thought, I thought, how fascinating if I could know more about my future. I should know. I should be more aware for myself, for my children. If there's something I could prevent from the future or live my life in a different way, why not learn? Why not help myself? I was involved. I'm not a bioethicist, but I'm on the Nuffield Council of Bioethics. We've just done a big report on personalised genomics, and we interviewed the guys from Decode Me and various of these things, and they said, surely all knowledge is good knowledge. Why should you try and keep this knowledge from individuals? If individuals can get this knowledge, surely it must be an advantage to them for getting this knowledge. And if you regulators and ethicists try and stop people getting their knowledge, you're just like the kind of people who try to prevent women getting home pregnancy tests because you felt this was too dangerous information to let out. But I don't necessarily think that that is quite the case, because I think it would be the case, and I don't even want to talk about Michael Crichton, it would be the case if these genetic tests gave you any medically useful information which you could act upon. But I think the sad thing, or maybe the good thing about these genetic tests is A, they don't give you any useful information, and B, if they do give you useful information, it's pretty much impossible to act upon it. suppose, I'm sure you've all done courses at the Methodology Institute when you were at the LSE, and suppose you were to be told that your risk of developing a particular condition, let's say it's Alzheimer's, you had a 50% increased risk of developing Alzheimer's. 50% increased lifetime risk of developing Alzheimer's. Now, what on earth would that mean? Firstly, what on earth would that mean? How on earth would you go about calculating what that would mean? Well, perhaps the first thing you would need to know is the risk of developing Alzheimer's or a disease in the population as a whole. Suppose 2 people in 100 developed a disease in the population as a whole. And suppose your risk of developing a disease was 50% increased. That would mean that you were in a group where 3 people in 100 in your group would develop Alzheimer's disease. So your risk had been increased 50%, which sounds huge, but the fact that you're in a group where only 3 people in 100 are going to develop the disorder is of no interest to you whatsoever. Absolutely gives you no clinical, no therapeutic interest whatsoever. And the second thing is, well, as we'll see in a moment, not quite as simple as that. The second thing is that actually if you knew this information, it would be very difficult for you to do anything about it. Because many of these conditions, there's nothing that you can do about them to be empowered, apart from things that you would do anyway. Be prudent in your life, don't drink too much, don't eat too much saturated fat, get a lot of exercise, then perhaps you'll feel a lot better. Almost all these diseases, so-called common complex diseases, we're not talking about Huntington's disease, we're not talking about the diseases where there's just one gene that goes wrong. We're talking about the diseases that bring most of us to our death, which are complicated diseases involving hundreds and thousands of variations in the genome at many, many points. There's been a huge investment in research to try and find the genetic basis of these diseases. These are the so-called genome-wide association studies. I'm not going to go into them in any detail. A vast amount of money has been poured into these studies, and they've actually found out quite a lot about genetic susceptibility to a whole range of conditions, and you can see all these conditions here. But the risks that they're finding, the risk levels that they're finding, are really so small as not to usher in a new era of preventive and predictive medicine at all. So you might well be in the situation here where you receive information about the fact that you've got an elevated risk. You don't know how to interpret that information. You live under the cloud of that information, and there's almost nothing you can do about this. Now, that's Alzheimer's disease, which is a difficult disease. Suppose it was a disease of childhood, like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Your child was destined to have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Tell the doctors, tell the parents, tell the teachers. Every time the child gets a little bit fidgety, you think, hello, is that the kid's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? Or suppose it was Alzheimer's. Did I just say that? Every tiny little lapse of memory. Hold on, is that the dementia beginning to kick in? Perhaps I'd better go to the doctor, perhaps I'd better take a test, perhaps I'd better take a pill. We'll come to the pills in a second. The arguments that I'm making, or the phenomenon that I'm pointing to, may seem quite abstract, but in fact, they're not abstract at all, because there's a great pressure, especially in European health services, to move to these personalized, predictive, and preventive services. This was our former Minister of Health in the UK, Alan Johnson, who is now our Shadow Chancellor of the Exchequer, promising a personalized health service. You don't want one size fits all. You don't want to just go to the doctor and get the treatment that everybody else gets. You want the doctor to know what's your disease, what's your problem, and what pill is appropriate for you. Baylor College of Medicine, a very big college of medicine in Houston, in Texas, promising personalized medicine. Why I'm showing that is because this thing down here, this personalized gene chip, which they've developed at Baylor College of Medicine, is to identify your susceptibility for 161 diseases, so every individual who goes to Baylor College of Medicine will in the future have their gene sequenced to see if they're susceptible for these kinds of diseases. This medicine, if some of these enthusiasts are right, is the kind of medicine that's going to be coming to you soon. Now, I think, as I just indicated, there are some real problems in this dream of genetic medicine. I mean, there's actually one small problem, which is that if you send your spit sample off to three different providers, they'll give you three different risk estimates, some of them varying quite enormously because the technology isn't particularly good. Even if the assessments are reliable, as I've already said, they've got very little clinical relevance. If you're told you have a 50% increased risk, and very few of them tell you that, they tell you you have a 12% increased risk or a 2% increased risk, what do you know? How are you going to interpret that information? What does that mean about all the other factors other than genetics? But what we do know is that when people are given a number, your risk is increased by 50%, that number is very salient to you. It's a very powerful thing to be given a number, and it's a number which is quite difficult to forget and which you believe is certain. Numbers sound much more certain than they are. Now, there's two other kind of interesting things that are going on here, I think. If you go back to these companies here, these are not tests that your doctor orders up for you. These are not tests that you get as part of your public health system. I'm delighted to say China's beginning to go back to an insurance-based system. These are not tests that your doctor says because you go to the doctor and you're feeling unwell. You buy these tests personally. This is your test. It's my genes. It's my knowledge. It's me. I'm going to buy this test, and it's going to tell me about me. Now, the whole principle of health services, certainly in the UK and Europe, national health services, was that risk for health and illness was shared amongst the population. You paid your money into an insurance pool, everybody had a pooled risk, and in the British National Health Service system and many other European systems, you were treated free at the point of care, irrespective of whether you were in a high-risk group or a low-risk group. You pooled risk. It was mutuality. It was social risk. It was social solidarity. It was social rights. These are not about that at all. They're about the unpooling of risk. They're about finding out your risk and your family risk and taking care of your family and your risk and taking responsibility for your family and your risk by taking out your own private insurance. So I think these things, these commodified and consumerized based technologies like this, indicate something quite much more general about our society, about some societies at least, which is the collapse or the difficulty of sustaining those principles of mutuality, of solidarity, of collectivity that were actually so crucial in European welfare states, at least across the whole of the 20th century. If you and only you and your family are responsible for your illness, for your disease, for understanding it, for managing it, for paying for it, for insuring against it, and to hell with your neighbours, let alone people a thousand miles away, well, something significant is happening there. Anyhow, what is predictive medicine? Is it always better to know than to not know? Is it always better to know your disease than to not know your disease? Or to know that in the future you might have the likelihood of developing a disease? Would you like to know that you had a 70% chance of developing breast cancer? Well, we know that there are some forms of hereditary breast cancer where there are these very high risks, and some people do take very desperate measures. Preventive double mastectomies in some cases, families with a high risk of colon cancer, people have part of their colon removed because they have a high risk. Okay, a very high risk. Even that high risk is not certainty. But suppose a lower risk. What measures would you take if you thought you had a 50% risk? Or you thought your child had a 50% risk? Or you thought your prospective child had a 50% risk? What kind of world are we going to live in when we bring that future into the present, that uncertain future back into the present, and feel that we must act in the present in relation to that uncertain future? We know what happens in those cases. There are many, many, many false positives. There are many, many cases where people are intervened upon where they would never develop the disease at all. Tremendously good example, although it's not one of these, is the example of high cholesterol levels for heart attack. And some of you may know that perhaps the best-selling drugs at the moment are the statins, the so-called statins, lipid-lowering drugs. Lipid-lowering drugs treat a risk factor. They don't actually treat you for heart disease. You don't have to be diagnosed for heart disease. You are found to have a high level of lipids, of fat in your blood, and you take these lipid-lowering drugs. Now, in that case, fine. It doesn't really matter if you're going to develop the disease or not develop the disease, because the side effects of a lipid-lowering drug are very small. The side effects of a small dose of aspirin for people who may be, for men over a certain age, who may feel at risk of stroke, are also at one stage thought to be quite small. Actually, at another stage they thought, well, they did lead to gastric bleeding. Then at another stage they thought they were quite small. So at what point do you intervene? And who decides what to intervene? And should we begin to live our lives totally under the shadow of illness? Because actually, if you do this kind of work, you find that nobody is normal. Actually, everybody's got a bunch of little anomalies. Again, with this Nuffield Council report that I was involved in, we were talking to some people, I'll show this in a second, one of the other things that people do in screening, I don't know if this is in China, is they have the scans, body scans. So you go and you have an MRI scan. You should never have a CT scan, by the way. Never have a whole body CT scan. If they offer it to you, just don't have it, because the dose of radiation that you'll get from a whole body CT scan, it's like 200 x-rays, and it's carcinogenic in itself, and they should be banned. But the same, it's fine if the doctor says go and have a scan, then go and have a scan, but don't just go in off the street and buy a whole body CT scan. But suppose you go in off the street and have an MRI scan, which doesn't use radiation. You talk to someone who does MRI scanning, and he'll say, well, actually, the problem with the MRI scan is that no one is normal. Everybody has a bunch of little anomalies. And once you've seen the bunch of little abnormalities, well, what do? Do you intervene? Most of these abnormalities will cause nobody any problems throughout the whole of your life. But knowing, screening, and this belief that earlier is almost always better, kind of produces a life in which almost no one is normal. Everybody is under the doctor. Everybody feels under the shadow of illness most of the time. Nonetheless, you see this massive screening program happening almost everywhere. I was amused to find that the National Screening Program in the United States, its website is called Genes Are Us. These are the kind of body scans, life scans. These are the ones where you can just walk in off the street and get your health MOT. You can find out the real answer to how you are today. That's a rather odd thought. You felt you were feeling fine. I was feeling fine today, doctor. Oh, sorry, we've done the scan and discovered that you've got a bunch of little anomalies. So what you feel about yourself is not what the scan tells you about yourself. Dementia screening. Now, you may feel you're absolutely fine, but you have a scan to see whether or not you have incipient dementia. You scan children to see whether children have the brain patterns, the abnormal brain patterns, which they share in common with people with antisocial personality disorder. Are these kids... I know it sounds funny, but believe me, I'm a visiting professor at the Institute of Psychiatry. Institute of Psychiatry, they're putting kids, 8-year-old kids, into scanners. This is at the research stage at the moment, to see if they can identify in those 8-year-old kids, the patterns of brain activity that they see in adult psychopaths. Well, parents, I'm terribly sorry to say that 8-year-old Jimmy has just had his brain scan, and we're afraid that he has an 80%, a 60%, a 40% likelihood of turning into a person with antisocial personality disorder when he grows up. Now, the people doing this work, they are not monsters. They say, look, the lives of kids who grow up into these with antisocial personality disorders are miserable for their families, miserable for them, miserable for the schools, very expensive for society. Surely it's better to know and intervene early. Well, you may even think if you knew with absolute 100% certainty, that would be a bit of a problem. But if you know with 30% certainty, and you're identifying another 70% of kids who are never going to have this problem, and they are going to be, in the eyes of the teacher, the doctor, and everybody else, kids at liable to develop antisocial personality disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that is perhaps a problem of stigma which needs to be looked at. I'm particularly interested in what happens at the other end of life, being at the other end of life myself. One of the interesting diagnoses that's recently developed is a diagnosis called mild cognitive impairment. Mild cognitive impairment is to be differentiated from just loss of memory in old age. People think it is perhaps a precursor of development of dementia and Alzheimer's. So there's a big screening program, attempts to develop screening for mild cognitive impairment. You can imagine the scenario. I'm very forgetful, I've left my keys behind, I've lost my spectacles for the 43rd time, I can't remember where I'm supposed to be today, and my dear wife says, Nick, I think perhaps we should nip down to the doctor because I'm a little bit worried about your memory. I say, look, I'm absolutely, absolutely fine, there's nothing wrong with me, I don't want to go to the doctor. Finally, I'm persuaded to go to the doctor. The doctor goes through a rating scale. The doctor says, well, we think that possibly you're suffering from mild cognitive impairment. I say, what does that mean, doctor? He says, well, we don't know, but in 30 or 40% of cases, mild cognitive impairment leads on implacably to dementia. I say, well, is there nothing you can do about that? And he says, well, perhaps we should do a brain scan. So he does a brain scan. And then he says, well, there's absolutely nothing we can do, but perhaps you should put your affairs in order. So my loving wife and myself go onto the web, of course, and we come to this particular drug company that makes a drug called Aricept. Aricept is not a cure for dementia, but it's, in some people's eyes, it slows the onset of dementia. And actually, if you look at this website, well, maybe your sensibilities are different from mine, but to my mind, the heartstrings which are tugged by the people who are trying to sell this drug to you with unproven effect, keep your loved one with you a little bit longer. Now, who could resist going immediately to your doctor and saying, doctor, I'd like to keep my loved one with me a little bit longer? Or if you didn't go to your doctor and somebody says to you, you don't want to keep your loved one with you a little bit longer? Right at the beginning, I said that these things are interesting, not just culturally, not just ethically, not just medically, but also economically. And without wanting to go into the details here, because I've already talked for too long, many of the developments that I've talked about are driven by economic concerns. The biotechnology industry is a huge and burgeoning industry. It's an industry which governments want to invest in. This is the OECD in Europe trying to develop the European place in the global bioeconomy. It's an issue that market researchers are very interested in. They're very active market researchers trying to scope out where are the next things that you should invest in. Very good, by the way, two pieces of advice. Don't take my financial advice because I'm as poor as a church mouse, but invest in medical devices. Because medical devices, those artificial hips and those artificial knees with an aging population, believe me, that is an absolutely, that's an absolute cert. And the other thing which is an absolute cert is biomarkers. Biomarkers, all the things I've talked about, the things that believe, that purport to be able to identify an illness before it arrives. This is a very, very big market opportunity, and you can see all these guys that I won't go into here who are working very, very hard in this area. So, I think there are issues at a whole lot of levels here, and I'll just conclude with this slide. Firstly, there are issues about the new way in which this research is funded, this research is developed, and this research, the direction of this research is shaped. And I think in biomedical research, in particular, the shape of research, the pathway to biomedical truth, is path dependent. People invest in research if they believe that there's going to be a product that they're going to be able to sell into a market. And that little sequence, research, product, market, actually goes the other way. Market, then what might be the product, then where should the research be? And I don't think it is too crude for me to say that a great deal of research that's being done, not just in the commercial sector, but in the universities, is driven by the prospect of intellectual property and a market in the future. It's not to say that this research doesn't produce the truth, produces some kinds of truth, but it steers research into one path, the path that can make money, to be very crude about it, and it steers it away from the paths that are not going to make any money at all. This is not just the commercial, not just nasty capitalists, etc., etc. It's also government investing very heavily in this area because they want to move into the global biotechnology arena. But I think in the course of this, in the course of this strange alliance of truth and knowledge and money, and in particular in this predictive, preventive, personalised field, we're beginning to see a change in the way in which how individuals think about themselves. We're beginning to see individuals believe that they can find out more information about the diseases that they, their family and their kids are going to have, and that they in some way must take responsibility for managing their own conditions and managing their own life. That it's my life in my hands, it's not our life, it's not social insurance, it's my life that I must take responsibility to manage, and that I must in some way or other treat medicine as like any other commodity, and if I can buy it and if I can spend enough on it, then I must be able to do something about my health. So medicine and health itself becomes a kind of consumption goods. Now, I'm an old-fashioned liberal, and I regret the passing of social insurance. I regret the passing pooling of risks. I regret the passing of the view that when it comes to health and illness, we're all in it together, and what strikes you today could strike me tomorrow, and therefore I do owe my brother and sister something, at least enough to pay into an insurance pool, so if it happens to you, you're secure, and if it happens to me, I'm secure. And also, I feel slightly uneasy about this idea that illness is now not just an occasional state, that we live most of our lives in a state of health and occasionally we fall ill. But this idea that somehow we are all pre-symptomatically ill, we're all asymptomatically ill, there's illness lurking within us and the shadow of illness should fall over us all the time, and the whole of our life, the whole way in which we should manage our life, whether it's going to the gym, whether it's what food we eat, whether it's what we drink, whether it's how we treat our children, all that should be calculated according to a logic of health and illness. I would like to think there are higher values that we might think about and strive towards, apart from the value of just maintaining our bodies in our earthly existence. But then, as I said, I'm an old-fashioned liberal. And I just want to stop with this slide from Professor Yang Hua Ming. I don't know if the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe ever arrived here in China, but those of you who ever did come across the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe might recall that the question to life, meaning the universe and everything, answer to that question was 42. Professor Yang Hua Ming, in this slide, which I rather like, said, yes, that's absolutely right. The answer to the question about life, the universe, and everything is 42. And the 42 for him are the four bases of DNA, C's, A's, and G and T, and the two binaries of the digital code, 1 and 2. When you combine the four bases of DNA and the 1 and 2 of the digital code, you unlock the human genome. And once you unlock the human genome, in this view, you've got the answer to the question about life, the universe, and everything. I don't know that I would accept that answer, but it's one answer. So anyhow, thanks for your attention. Yeah, so we can take some comments, questions. Please.
Some kind of a dividing line between different classes. And in China, it's among different cultures. In Belgium, they're enjoying different policies here. That kind of, you know, inequality or something, you know, people in the whatever.
Yeah.
Was discriminated in some way. But on this one, I think the biofuel might be, raise another challenging question. It's not only about, you know, you're not, you can also mention that you're not the same species sometimes. If you reorganize your genus, you know, get them purified. I'm not saying no to this new method, but only consider about the challenges, the problems it might bring about.
I think there's something that some of you may have seen a film called Gattaca, which did imagine the fact that people would tamper with their genes and things like that. That's kind of quite difficult to do. But I think at least one part of your question is absolutely right. In insurance-based systems like the one that you just mentioned, some are completely universal, so everybody is covered at the same level. But some do make differences, and I know your Chinese system that you're introducing, there are different insurance schemes in the cities, there are different insurance schemes for people who come in the cities to work, there are different insurance schemes for rural areas. So as you say, they're kind of stratified according to all sorts of things. At the moment, they're not stratified according to genetics. If you go into a private insurance scheme, of course, the first thing they'll ask you is your health history, and they'll ask you your family history. And if they ask you when your parents died and what your parents died of, and on that basis they'll make an estimate of your risk levels, and they'll put you in different risk pools. So they already, to some extent, take account of what they believe to be your hereditary likelihood in private schemes, not in public schemes. In private schemes, these kinds of developments, I think, raise a real problem. Because they do raise a problem that if you've gone in for one of these tests, you would have to disclose this to the insurance company, and if you've shown to have a high risk in something, you'll either be uninsurable, or else you'll be insured at a higher level. Or, in the future, that insurance companies might ask people to go in and have these tests before they will issue private insurance. Now, in the UK, there's a voluntary scheme that the insurance companies say they're not going to ask for this genetic information. In the United States, where there was a very big anxiety about this, there was a big lobby for the passage of a new act, and an act, a Genetic Discrimination Act, the so-called GINA Act, was passed about a year or so ago, which forbade genetic discrimination. We've talked to the insurance companies, councils that I'm involved in, talk to the insurance companies, and they say that at the moment the genetic information gives you no better information than your family history. But one can imagine a situation, and this is the situation that is often imagined in the slightly science fiction things, where some people at high risk would be considered to be completely uninsurable. They go out of the risk pool and you would just not be able to be insured because you were at such a high risk level. So one can certainly imagine those genetic discrimination effects happening. And in countries where they've experienced genetic discrimination, in the past, Germany in particular, this is a very, very, very big anxiety and a big mobilization against the use of any of these types of genetic testing. So these, you know, the politics, the political background shapes these things greatly. And of course, you know, in China, you're not too far distant from your eugenic mother and child policies, your eugenic maternity care, which didn't use any of these advanced technologies at all, but did argue that certain families, certain people should not get married, and if they did get married, they should be sterilized. I'm glad to say, in part because of the sterling work of some of the people we were collaborating with in our BioNet project, people like Qiu Renzong, the fantastic bioethicist here in Beijing, those maternal health, mother and child laws, too tired to remember, must take my Aricept, they've been overturned. But you know, one can see those futures, absolutely. Would you mind if I just go and get myself a glass?
any other comments, questions? Yes, just behind you there, first of all. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you raised two very important questions. And the first question is that there's an imbalance between our ability to know and our ability to do anything. Many of these tests that I've been talking about for common diseases, I don't think we know very much, and I'll just talk about them in a second. But there are some diseases that we do know quite a lot about. I mentioned this in one of our earlier discussions today. There's a disease called Huntington's disease. It's a degenerative disease. You develop a kind of shaking. It's not like Parkinson's. It's worse than Parkinson's. It's a degenerative disease for which there is no cure. Huntington's disease. The famous folk singer, probably before any of your time, Woody Guthrie, died of Huntington's, and it's a horrible disease. In the 1980s, there was a big research effort to find the genetic basis of this disease, especially funded by and organized by some families that had this disease, because it runs in families. And they found the genetic basis in 1983, and they sequenced the genes in about 10 years later. So that was in about early 1990s. So in early 1990s, they knew exactly what the genetic basis. This was a very clear genetic disease. They knew if you had one particular genetic makeup, you wouldn't get this disease. If you had another genetic makeup, you would get the disease. And you could get a test to tell you. Two things are very interesting. One is that 20 years later, we have no therapy for the disease whatsoever. So we know, but we can't do anything about it. And the other is that at least half the people who have a family history of this disease choose not to take the test. They prefer not to know, even though in this particular case, the test could tell them with pretty much absolute certainty that they were going to develop the disease, but they prefer not to live their life under that disease, under the knowledge. They prefer to live a life of uncertainty than a life of certainty, even if the test could free them. That's the first thing. And the second thing which you say, which is also right, is that even knowledge which you know is uncertain can change you. And I'll just tell you a little story. I do some work in the area of neuroscience, and we run these things called neuroschools, where we bring about 8 social scientists and 8 neuroscientists at PhD level together. We bring them into a laboratory situation. They do research on something for about a week together, and the neuroscientists learn about social scientists learn about neuroscience. So it happened a few weeks ago, we were in Germany, in Würzburg, and in Würzburg, a very eminent professor who was running this school about 15 years ago had discovered one genetic variant, one tiny little genetic variant that in some loose ways had been associated with your susceptibility to depression, to alcoholism, and to antisocial behavior. It's one tiny little variant. As a little experiment, the 18 or so of us in our group, we all genotyped ourselves for this one tiny little variant. We have 4-hour lecture from Klaus Peter Lesch saying this means absolutely nothing. An individual, this variation means absolutely nothing. At a population level, it means that people in one group or another group may be more or less liable, but for you, this means absolutely nothing.
So 18 of us, we all went and genotyped ourselves. We scraped our things and we did the DNA testing and we got the gels and we got the indications back and tested, etc. And amongst the 18 of us, we were pretty much like the average population, and two of us had the genetic variation that is likely to lead people to be more susceptible to alcoholism, to drug abuse, to depression, to suicide, to the effects. Believe me, after the 4-hour lecture, having been told that this means absolutely nothing, within half an hour, when we all went away and had a glass of wine, everybody was reinterpreting their past in terms of their knowledge of this tiny little genetic makeup. And once you know it, I know mine. And of course, I'm in the vulnerable. I'm vulnerable to alcoholism, drugs, greed, depression, etc., etc. I'm one of the unlucky 15% minority. That's right. And that's the reason why I had one too many glasses of wine. So you're right. And it may sound a silly example, but once you know this, it's very, very difficult to unknow it. And once other people, and this is a trivial example, but suppose it was a test for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, test for Alzheimer's, which your family, your mother, spouse knew, something like that. Once you know it, impossible to unknow. So I think even if it was certain knowledge, I don't think one would necessarily want to know, uncertain knowledge, which has an effect, which may be a dangerous effect. Not all knowledge, not all uncertain knowledge is good knowledge, is my view. So you were going to ask?
I don't know. My question is quite practical. So I wonder if you can tell the data for the beginning, and after that it's going to be a very high risk of some kind of disease in the future. And he maybe got some kind of insurance just for this kind of disease, because he just paid the normal rate, and he will get very high risk in the future to get cardiac disease. On the other hand, maybe the insurance company will ask everybody to make the disease the body thing in the future, and sometimes maybe to give the human virus to keep them away, because it's very risk, it's very high risk in the future and sometimes cost disease.
Yeah, I think the insurance companies are worried about a phenomenon that they call moral hazard.
Yeah.
Moral hazard. So what is moral hazard? So if I've had the scan and I know that I'm at high risk of lung cancer or something like that, but I don't declare that when I go for my insurance, then I've gone into a risk pool with everybody else who hasn't got that high risk. And in a sense, then, all those other people are paying their premium in order to deal with my high-risk situation. So that's a situation of moral hazard. And we see this in an issue that insurance companies are very, very worried about in all sorts of areas. So this is why the insurance company asks you to declare you're all too young to have gone in for private insurance. I know, but if you do go into private insurance, they ask you to, or even to travel insurance, they ask you to declare your pre-existing conditions. Because if you don't declare your pre-existing conditions, actually your insurance policy is null and void. If you don't declare your insurance, your pre-existing conditions, then you are placed in this position of moral hazard, because you are at a higher risk for this disorder, but you've gone into the risk pool with everybody else. So these kinds of underwriting systems, in which people are judged for risk before they gain their insurance, are quite common in private insurance schemes. The thing about the public insurance schemes, and actually if you go back to William Beveridge and the foundation of the social insurance schemes in the United Kingdom, he says this absolutely explicitly. We are not going to differentiate between people on the basis of whether or not they are at higher or lower risk. Except in exceptional circumstances, we're going to assume that everybody is in the same risk pool. And he said something rather romantic, like, it's more consistent with the values and beliefs of the British people that everybody should be in this together. And this is likely to gain public assent. not just because he was a former director of the London School of Economics, but he did have some rather murky secrets in his past, William Beveridge. But on this thing, I think he was quite right. And actually, you know, in some ways, and to risk assess everybody and to have different insurance schemes and different insurance premiums for everybody may produce a system which is actually so expensive to run, to administer, to calculate, that it's simply not worth the cost. I don't think insurance companies really want to go that way. They don't want to go that way. Yeah. Well, this was one of the themes of this three-year research project that we've just concluded. I think it's very difficult to generalize about Western regulators, but I think to be at the most general, the answer would be like this. Provided the clinical trials are carried out according to the laws of the country in which they take place, then that is not for us to judge. What they are, but that is, it's a little bit more difficult than that. For a number of reasons. Firstly, most pharmaceutical companies in the West don't actually carry out the trial themselves. They contract out the trial to a contract research organization. They know that the trial requires, say, 400 people on the drug, 400 people with a similar condition not on the drug. They make the contract on the basis of a certain amount of money per head of the person that you recruit into the trial. Okay, so clearly for the research organization, which is a commercial organization, they basically want to get as many people into the trial as cheaply as they can. That's why they go to Brazil. That's why they go to Poland, actually, where the former Eastern European countries are other hunting grounds. That's why they went to India, and that's why they go to China. So then what happens? So they go to province which shall remain nameless. They go to a hospital in a province which shall remain nameless, where the hospital is short of money and the doctors are short of money and the patients have not really received any health checkup. And they say to the doctors, well, we will pay you so much for every patient you recruit into the trial. And they say to the hospital, well, we'll pay you so much if we can have this arm of the trial based in your hospital. And they say to the patient, well, if you come for our trial, we'll give you a health checkup. And in that way, the doctor is doing reasonably well, the hospital is doing reasonably well, the subject gets a kind of inducement to go into the trial. So well, so good, you might say, provided in the end the trial is robust and the data is robust. But quite often the data isn't robust, because it's often the case that everybody feels that they've got an interest in showing that the trial drug, the drug that the commercial company wants to get onto the marketplace, is actually doing better than the non-trial drug, and so the data lacks robustness. And without wanting to be specific, certainly this concern about data integrity has concerned the pharmaceutical companies themselves. The concern about the way in which doctors and hospitals and patients are lured into the trials has also concerned the regulators. And the general outsourcing, the whole business of outsourcing, is, I think, very, very problematic. And the fact that in different countries there are very different ethical regimes. And even if there are very sound ethical regimes in a big country, it's often hard to enforce them. I know you may know the problems that there were in the State Food and Drug Authority recently. And even after the unfortunate events, let's call them that, in the State Food and Drug Authority, are very unfortunate for the senior officials there, it was still the case that they find it very difficult to enforce their regulations at a hospital thousands and thousands of miles away. They can write their regulations, but they can't enforce them, they can't implement them. And our view from our research in China is that over the last few years, the regulatory regime, at least in terms of the written regulations, has really tightened up. People have become very, very aware of this. They don't want China to be a happy hunting ground for people to come in and test their unreliable drugs. And they don't want people to question the integrity of the data that comes out of clinical trials in China. So the written regulations have been tightened up, and our friends at the Ministry of Health and our bioethics friends here at PKU have done a great job in doing that. But the problem is a problem of inspection, the problem is a problem of implementation, the problem is a problem of the structures, the structure where you have very poor people who have incentives to go into the trials, and so on. And it's honestly not specific to China. In this Bionet project, we had a colleague from Poland, and the drug companies were going around the homes for homeless people, recruiting their subjects from homeless people, offering them a meal and a cup of tea. A person who goes into a clinical trial has to give informed consent. They have to sign the, you know, I know what the trial is, I know what the risks are, thank you very much. If you're homeless and desperate, and you're getting a cup of tea and somewhere to sleep for the night, well, is that free informed consent? So I think those are the anxieties. Everybody loves to hate the drug companies, I know. And I know that we work very closely in this Bionet project with Novartis, senior official from Novartis. And he said Novartis has really got no interest in promoting these kinds of data that we can't rely upon, you know. So they've actually worked quite hard to improve the regime. But it's, you know, this is just one of the areas where there are many difficulties in a country as big and diverse as China. And the difficulties are not just individuals. I have to stress this. If you have a healthcare system where you underpay your doctors, and you have a healthcare system in which people are not getting access to medical care, they will do these things. In Poland, people say, absolutely, why don't we go in the clinical trial? Because the doctor doesn't give a damn about me. And the only way the doctor is going to care about me and monitor my health is if I go into the clinical trial. Because otherwise, as far as the doctor's concerned, I simply don't exist. So people are induced into the trial for all sorts of reasons. How are we doing? Questions? Comments? Time for time.
Right, that's it.